Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and to age of ages. Amen. We are looking at the Maccabean Revolt tonight. I was trying to think of some different topics that might be of interest for people. And as I was pondering the different options, the Maccabean Revolt just seems so appropriate for our present political situation. So, Maccabean Revolt, recorded in the first couple chapters of the book, first book of Maccabees. So those logged in tonight for the Bible study, you probably all have a Bible in which the books of Maccabees are in there. Most Bibles, I think, today actually have them in. Even a Protestant Bible will typically have the at least even the four books of Maccabees in there. If you've never read all four books, you really should. The third and fourth are kind of fun too. But First Maccabees is the most important. The Second Maccabees is a little bit more hyperbolic, a little more colorful. And then when you get into Third and Fourth Maccabees, they continue in that vein. But First Maccabees is basically your history book. It kind of lays out the basic storyline of what's going on, and a little bit more dry, but certainly a lot of color in here as well. But so we're going to look at the Maccabean Revolt as it is described in First Maccabees, though some of these things also are paralleled in Second Maccabees. And some of the events and other things, again, you'll find these in Third and Fourth Maccabees too. But for what we're doing here tonight, First Maccabees, you'll find that usually at the end of your Old Testament, although some Bibles today will put First and Second Maccabees at the end of the historical books and before the prophets, which is a perfectly logical place to put it as well, after, say, Nehemiah or something. But wherever you find your Bible, you can turn to First Maccabees. These are probably the latest books of the Old Testament literature. They are written in Greek, although some have suggested there may be a Hebrew literary background to them. That's perfectly possible. As you read the Greek of First Maccabees, there are a number of Semitisms in the Greek. That is then taken to suggest that there is an actual Hebrew text from which it is then translated into Greek. That's perfectly possible. It's also very possible that you just have here some very heavy Semitic influence on the Greek as it's written down, maybe Greek as a second language. And the New Testament is like that. When you look at the New Testament, the Greek and the New Testament, you find tons of Semitisms in there. That does not imply necessarily that there's a text written in Hebrew translated into Greek. No, just the actual one who is composing this, they speak Greek either because they're bilingual and maybe their mother tongue is, say, Aramaic or Hebrew. They speak Greek with a Semitic flavor, or maybe they grew up in a region where Greek is being spoken with a Semitic flavor, say in Palestine or something. So the book is written in Greek. First Maccabees is written in Greek. The only text that we have of it in Greek. The stories, however, are preserved among the Jews to this day. So if you ask a Jew about the story of Judas Maccabeus, they'll tell you the story. The story of Hanukkah comes from the stories of the Maccabean Wars and their cleansing of the temple in Jerusalem. So these are Old Testament books. This is Jewish literature. This is pre-Christian Jewish literature. But the latter Jewish literature is written in Greek. They wrote down their literature in the language that they spoke. So old Jewish literature written in Hebrew. The intermediate stuff is written in Aramaic. And then the very late stuff is written in Greek, which actually tracks with the common language of the people at the time. All right. After Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated Darius, king of the Persians and the Medes. He succeeded him as king. He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death the kings of the earth. He advanced to the ends of the earth and plundered many nations. When the earth became quiet before him, he was exalted, and his heart was lifted up. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries, nations, princes, and they became tributary to him. So you date that to right around 331. If you want to put a date there, a little paragraph break there maybe in your Bible, 331. The Persians fall to Alexander in 331. So you remember Alexander the Great, his father was from Macedonia, Philip the Macedonian. Alexander takes over Greece and then eventually takes over what we would call modern day Turkey and heads east from there all the way into Persia. And into really modern day India. He eventually comes to Western India and then says, okay, that's enough. Or maybe his general said, okay, I think we've gone far enough. Let's go home. So now they turn around and they head back and Alexander eventually dies. And the story of his death is in verse 5. After this, he fell sick and perceived that he was dying. Many have suggested different causes of this death. It might have been just a really severe hangover after all the celebrations from the wars. Who knows? But he fell sick and perceived that he was dying. So he summoned his most honored officers who had been brought up with him from youth and divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. And after Alexander had reigned 12 years, he died, 323 BC, the death of Alexander the Great. Okay, so when did he divide his empire? How did he divide his empire? How many ways in which did he divide his empire is beyond what we can do here. The historians debate about all the complexities of it, and it really doesn't matter too much for what we're doing tonight. But his kingdom after he died, all historians agree, was divided up over various periods after that into distinct kingdoms, mostly due to the military influences of the divisions of his army. Verse 8, then his officers began to rule each in his own place. They all put on crowns after his death, and so did their sons after them for many years, and they caused many evils on the earth. So the author there tells you that right there you hear about the complexity. So the kingdom before he died had been divided into these different governing sections. And then he eventually dies and those sections are divided up and the various generals split things up and start fighting amongst themselves. Not only the generals, but in the sons of the generals and the sons of the generals. So you eventually get to a point where you have approximately four different major kingdoms coming from Alexander. And what's important for us here is the kingdom of Seleucus, the Seleucid kingdom, which is the region of Syria, basically. And then also the Ptolemaic kingdom down in Egypt. Those are the two that are on the radar screen for what we're doing here in this book. The other kingdoms don't really matter too much for this book. Verse 10, and from them came forth a sinful root, Antiochus Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus the king. He had been a hostage in Rome. He began to reign in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. So this is also, by the way, the name from which we get the city Antioch, the city of Antioch up in Syria. This is one of that was up in his region. In those days, lawless men. So in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus the third. This is so Antiochus Epiphanes would be also Antiochus the fourth, the son of Antiochus the third, who was the king. In those days, lawless men came forth from Israel and misled many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles round about us. So when Antiochus Epiphanes is ruling in the north in Syria, at that time, we hear also in parallel to that, and there's probably some impetus from Antiochus, as we're going to see, there are people in Israel who are already aligning themselves with the non-Jewish world and with the Gentile or pagan world around them. And as described here, in those days, lawless men came forth from Israel. These are Jews. And misled many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles round about us. For since we separated from them, many evils have come upon us. This proposal seemed pleased them, and some of the people eagerly went to the king. He authorized them to observe the ordinance of the Gentiles. So they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem, according to the Gentile custom, and removed the marks of circumcision, and abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. Sounds like the USCCB. Okay, so from the Jews themselves, there are those that are from the Jews who say, hey, you know, why don't we ditch this whole covenant idea? Circumcision, the kosher laws, the law of God, worshiping only one God, that kind of stuff. Why don't we assimilate with those that are outside of the covenant? Why don't we assimilate with the Gentiles? And the best way to do that is for us to start taking on their customs. So they build a gymnasium. It is a naked place, literally in the Greek. So a gymnasium. This is a where they would do their different, you know, Greek activities of wrestling and exercises and all that kind of stuff from what we get the modern English for gymnasium. And this is why they need to, where they want to remove the marks of circumcision, because of course back then everything was done, as you know, without clothing. Verse 16. When Antiochus saw that his kingdom was established, he determined to become king of the land of Egypt. So he's got control. He's in Syria. And he's got control now of Palestine. Well, time to take control of Egypt, which is under the Ptolemaic kingdom. Another remnant of Alexander's military. So he decides to conquer Egypt. So verse 17. So he invaded Egypt with a strong force, with chariots and elephants and cavalry, and with a large fleet. He engaged Ptolemy, king of Egypt, in battle, and Ptolemy turned and fled before him, and many were wounded and fell, and they captured and fortified the cities in the land of Egypt, and he plundered the land of Egypt. After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. So what year is that? Well, historians debate about these things, but usually somewhere in the range of about 170 for round numbers, okay? About 170 BC. This would be, he went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the sanctuary and took the golden altar, the lampstand for the light, and all its utensils. He took also the table for the bread of the presence and the cup of drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtains, the crowns, the golden decoration, the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took all the hidden treasures which he found. Taking them all, he departed to his own land. Okay, so he's come through Palestine down to Egypt, and then returning with his army from Egypt to come back to Syria, he conquers Jerusalem and of course, plunders the temples, we hear. And then we get some poetry here. He committed deeds of murder, spoke with great arrogance. Israel mourned deeply in every community. Rulers and elders groaned. Maidens and young men became faint. The beauty of the women faded. Every bridegroom took up the lament. She who sat in the bridal chamber was mourning. Even the land shook for its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was clothed with shame. So there's some nice poetry there, speaking of you know, hyperbolically, of course, or how horrible it was. 2 years later, the king sent to the cities of Judah a chief collector of tribute, and he came to Jerusalem with a large force. He deceitfully he spoke peaceful words to them, and they believed him. But he suddenly fell upon the city, dealt with a severe blow, and destroyed many people of Israel. He plundered the city, burned it with fire, and tore down its houses and surrounding walls. And they took captive the women and the children, and seized the cattle. Then they fortified the city of David and a great strong wall with strong towers, and it became their citadel. And they stationed there a sinful people, lawless men. These strengthened their positions. They stored up arms and food, and collecting the spoils in Jerusalem, they stored them there and became a great snare. So the city of David, hard to know exactly if this is specifically, if the author is using this language in a kind of a technical way, the city of David would be, if he means that specifically, would refer to the, not all of Jerusalem, that is the larger version of it after Hezekiah, but maybe just simply that area that is just south of the Temple Mount. That would be the city of David, the original. Remember, the Jebusites had that skinny little pie-shaped city. And then David, his palace is in the northern part of that. And that whole city becomes the city of David. And today, when you go there on archaeological digs, that whole area is a big archaeological dig called the city of David. And then just north of that is the Temple Mount. So that would make sense, probably. They took over that area, a very small area. It's possible they took over the entire city of Jerusalem, but hard to know exactly what the author means by the city of David there. But verse 35, they stored up arms and food. Okay, verse 36, it became an ambush against the sanctuary, an evil adversary of Israel continually on every side. The sanctuary, they shed blood. Innocent blood, they even defiled the sanctuary because of the residents of Jerusalem fled. So it sounds again, so they've got control of that northern part of the city of David, the palace of David, that area there. And just north of that is the Temple Mount. But the city itself is a little larger, of course, after Hezekiah, the walls go out to the west. And so there are inhabitants in these other areas, but they're all starting to flee because of this. And it would make sense. Notice it says that they were in control of the temple. Well, the temple is right next to the palace of David there. Because of them, the residents of Jerusalem fled. She became a dwelling of strangers. She became strange to her offspring. Her children forsook her. Her sanctuary became desolate as a desert. Her feasts were turned into mourning. Her Sabbath into a reproach. Her honor into contempt. Her dishonor now grew as great as her glory. Her exaltation was turned into mourning. Verse 41, then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that each should give up his customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many even from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane the Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the Torah and change all the ordinances and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. In such words, he wrote to his whole kingdom, and he appointed inspectors over all the people and commanded the cities of Judah to offer sacrifice city by city. Many of the people, everyone who forsook the Torah, joined them, and they did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. Now, the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege. So this is a couple years later. They erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of burnt offering. So the desolating sacrilege upon the altar of burnt offering. So you remember the altar of burnt offering sits just outside the temple. And as far as we can discern from reading this text and then later on here, we'll see that it sounds like what they did is they built a pagan altar, some sort of pagan structure, on top of the altar of burnt offering. And then on top of that, they're offering these pagan sacrifices. The altar of burnt offering was probably, from a Gentile standpoint, a little too simple. It was just a big cube. And a big stone cube and kind of Solomon. And it didn't have a lot of, you know, fancy artwork to it or anything like that. So the pagans probably wanted to dress it up. And so they must have put some sort of a pagan structure, some sort of pagan altar sitting on top of the altar of burnt offering, which probably made a nice foundation because it was all stone. Let's see. A desolating sacrilege. Upon the altar of burnt offering, they also built altars in the surrounding cities of Judah and burned incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the law which they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Where the books of the covenant was found, book of the covenant was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the Torah, the decree of the king condemned him to death. They kept using violence against Israel, against those found month after month in the cities. And on the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar, which was upon the altar of burnt offering. So this is that abomination of desolation, or the abominating sacrilege. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised, and their families and those who circumcised them. And they hung the dead infants, from their mother's necks. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than be defiled by food or profane the Holy Covenant. And they did die. And very great wrath came upon Israel. So while you hear about horrible persecution of the Jews, and then you hear, which is even more difficult, I think, is that the Jews, there are many within the Jews, the people of Israel, who actually forsake the covenant and actually go along with these laws. There were, so the author doesn't leave you on that bad note, there were some within, among the people of God, who actually resisted this and actually stood up to the king's commands, and many of them died as a result, but not all. And the not all part is the story of the Maccabean revolt. So this is in chapter two, in those days, Mattathias. So chapter one is in many ways kind of like a summary statement, but now we get to some more specific details about how did this rebellion, how did these people who stood firm and resisted, how did it happen? This is chapter 2, verse 1. In those days, Mattathias, the son of John, the son of Simeon, a priest of the sons of Joiarib, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modin. He had five sons. So Modin's about 15 miles from Jerusalem, not too far out there. He had five sons: John, surnamed Gadi; Simon, called Thasi; Judas, called Maccabeus, so Maccabah, this is the the word for hammer, and that's usually suggested. It's in Greek, so we don't really know, but it's guessed that this is a Hebrew name from the Hebrew word for hammer. So Judas the hammer, which would make sense as you watch what he does next. Eleazar called Abiram and Jonathan called Apphus. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem and said, so this is Matthias with his sons. Alas, why was I born to see this ruin of my people and the ruin of the holy city and to dwell there when it was given over to the enemy, the sanctuary given over to aliens? Her temple has become like a man without honor. Her glorious vessels have been carried into captivity. Her babes have been killed in her streets, her youths by the sword of the foe. What nation has not inherited her palaces and has not seized her spoils? All her adornment has been taken away. No longer free, she has become a slave. And behold, our holy place, our beauty, and our glory have been laid waste. The Gentiles have profaned it. Why should we live any longer? And Mattathias and his sons rent their clothes and put on sackcloth and mourned greatly. Then the king's officers, who were enforcing the apostasy, came to the city of Modin to make them offer sacrifice. Many from Israel came to them. Mattathias and his sons were assembled. Then the king's officers spoke to Mattathias as follows. You are a leader, honored and great in this city, and supported by sons and brothers. Now, be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king. And you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. But Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, even if all the nations that live under the rule of the president-elect, the king, obey him and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each one from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the Torah and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar in Modin, according to the king's command. So can you imagine the situation? Here you've got the village is gathered. The officials of the king are standing there, you know, maybe 5 or 10 of them or something, with a couple soldiers or something. And they've got an altar set up to a pagan idol and a bowl of incense. And all the village has gathered around. And they say, okay, look, they pick out obviously the most influential, who is Mattathias, a priest of the line of Aaron. And they say, Mattathias, you and your sons, your brother, you are honored in this city, Mattathias. You're obviously respected. Why don't you be the first to come offer the incense? And then everything will follow after that. They're going to do whatever you do, of course, be the most influential. And then, of course, you'll be honored with great gifts from the king. So then Mattathias gives this great speech. He says, even if all of the Gentiles give up their religions for the religion of this king, and even if the other Jews, we will not do such a thing. We will not forsake the religion of our fathers for the religion of this pagan king. While he's giving this great speech, risking his neck, one of the citizens of the village, one of the Jews, said, I'll do it. I'll take a little prize. So he walks up and sprinkles some incense in front of the idol. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar of Modin, according to the king's command. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal and his heart was stirred. And he gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and killed him upon the altar. At the same time, he killed the king's officer who was enforcing them to sacrifice. and he tore down the altar. Thus he burned with zeal for the Torah, as Phinehas did against Zimri, the son of Salu. That's recorded in Numbers chapter 25, verses 6 through 9. Then Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenants come out with me." And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. So they fled to the hills. They took off. You hear this language in the New Testament. Flee to the hills. Leave the city. Flee the city. Then many who were seeking righteousness and justice went down to the wilderness to dwell there. They, their sons, their wives, their cattle, because evils pressed heavily upon them. Okay. Verse 42. Then there united with them a company of Hasadeans, mighty warriors of Israel. Hasadean, a pious one. So the pious ones here. Some sort of individuals who have decided to fight for the Torah. And all who became fugitive to escape their troubles joined them and reinforced them. They organized an army, struck down the sinners in their anger, lawless men in their wrath. The survivors fled to the Gentiles for safety. Mattathias and his friends went about and tore down the altars. They forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised boys that they found within the borders of Israel. They hunted down the arrogant men, and the work prospered in their hands. They rescued the Torah out of the hands of the Gentiles and kings, and they never let the sinner gain the upper hand. So there's a nice little summary of the rebellion under Mattathias. Now, the days drew near for Mattathias to die. So he's getting older. And he said to his sons, "Arrogance and reproach have now become strong, and it is a time of ruin and furious anger. Now, my children, show zeal for the Torah and give your lives for the covenant of our fathers." Now, I've mentioned this in other Bible studies on occasion. We've talked about salvation history and faith based on reason. And here is a classic example of this, where he requires of his sons faith, great faith, be willing to die. But then he gives a reason for that faith. "Remember the deeds of the fathers, which they did in their generations, and receive great honor and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful when tested? And it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Joseph, in the time of his distress, kept the commandment and became Lord of Egypt. Phinehas, his favorite, our father, because he was deeply zealous, received the covenant of everlasting priesthood. Joshua, because he fulfilled the command, became a judge in Israel. Caleb, because he testified in the assembly, received an inheritance in the land. David, because he was merciful, inherited the throne of the kingdom forever. Elijah, because of great zeal for the Torah, was taken up into heaven after his ecumenical meeting with the prophets of Baal. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael believed and were saved from the flame," the three friends of Daniel. "Daniel, because of his innocence, was delivered from the mouth of the lions." And so observe from generation to generation that none who put their trust in him will lack strength. So notice that you put your trust, this is that idea of faith, put your trust in the Lord and then you will have strength. So knowing what God has done in the past for those who have put their trust in him, then you can now put trust in him, knowing that he will give you strength. Now, my sons, right, this is his exhortation. And so observe from generation to generation that none who put their trust in him will lack strength. Do not fear the words of a sinner, for his splendor will turn into dung and worms. Today he will be exalted, but tomorrow he will not be found, because he has returned to the dust and his plans will perish. My children, be courageous, grow strong in the law, for by it you will gain honor. And now he lays out who's going to be in charge and what's going to go on after him. Almost like Alexander the Great, right? Laying things out. So now Mattathias lays things out. He says, okay, who's going to be in charge of his sons and what they're going to do, and they have the different roles. Judas Maccabeus is in charge of the army. And the stories of Judas Maccabeus, so the death of Mattathias, 166 approximately. You're keeping track of the dates here. But so here we are, just about 5-6 years after the Syrian conquest, or the Seleucid conquest of the region. Then chapter 3, Judas Maccabeus, his son, who was called Maccabeus, called the Hammer, took command in his place. All his brothers and all who joined his father helped him, and they gladly fought Israel. And you have a nice little hymn here, or song of Judas's great victory. Verse 10. Then, but Apollonius gathered together Gentiles and a large force from Samaria to fight against Israel. When Judas learned of it, he went out to meet him, and he defeated and killed him. Many were wounded and fell, and the rest fled. Then they seized their spoils, and Judas took the sword of Apollonius and used it in the battle the rest of his life. Now, in the ancient world, a sign of great victory, to take the sword of your enemy and use it against you, right? So this is what he's doing. Verse 13. Now, when Seron, the commander of the Syrian army, heard that Judas had gathered a large company, including a body of faithful men who stayed with him, and went out to battle, he said, I will make a name for myself, and win honor in the kingdom. I will make war on Judas and his companions, who scorned the king's commands. And again, a strong army, ungodly men, went up with him to help him to take vengeance on the sons of Israel. This is verse 16. When he approached the ascent of Beth Horon, Judas went out to meet him with a small company. This is just like what happened before. Judas doesn't have enough guys. Small company. But when they saw the army coming to meet them, they said to Judas, how can we, few as we are, fight against so great and strong a multitude? And we are faint, for we have eaten nothing today. Judas replied, it is easy for many to be hemmed in by few. From the sight of heaven, the sight of God, this is a classic example of Hebrew literature of the time, to a circumlocution, not God, but the place where God dwells, right? To avoid using the name of God, or even the word God now. So you could replace this if you want to in English here. For in the sight of God, there is no difference between saving by many or by few. It is not on the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but strength comes from God. And they come against us in great pride and lawlessness, to destroy us and our wives and our children and destroy us. But we fight for our lives and our laws. He, that is God, himself will crush them before us. As for you, do not be afraid of them. Verse 23. When he finished speaking, he rushed suddenly against Seron and his army, and they were crushed before him. I love that line. It's one of my most favorite lines in the whole book. Here he gives this wonderful speech. Here he's got a small army with him, and they can see that the odds are against them. There's this massive army of soldiers coming against this little band of warriors with Judas, and they say, you know, there's no way we can fight against these people. And Judas says, you misunderstand the battle. It's not that we are fighting against them. Rather, we are fighting for the protection of our wives and our children and our religion, our law. God will fight for us. That's all. That's simple. And so what he does is here, he encourages his warriors and says, look, this is in the hand of God. It's not in our hands. What's he thinking of? Why would he have this kind of courage? Well, Judas Maccabeus, as we can see from earlier in the book, has been catechized by his father. And his father has obviously been catechized by his father, and so on. They have passed down the stories of salvation history. So that Mattathias has raised his sons knowing what God has done for his people. Judas knows the stories of the great battles of ancient Israel. He knows that Israel often was outnumbered, but somehow was victorious. So he knows that even the present situation, though they are outnumbered, they certainly should be able to overcome these almost from a secular standpoint, impossible odds. And so he encourages them with those words. And then after having encouraged them, saying the battle is not in the hand of men, but the hand of God. And after having said that and saying, do not be afraid, and saying he himself will crush them before us. Look at that great faith. As for you, do not be afraid of them. That's all you got to do. Don't be afraid. And then verse 23, when he finished speaking, he suddenly rushed out against them. I love that. Right? Can you imagine? Here it is. He's got his army in front of him. He's encouraging them. Behind him, they're all watching this massive army approaching. And he stands between them and says, guys, you're not understanding this. This battle is not in our hands, in the hand of God. It doesn't matter how many people they've got, okay? The Lord will crush them before us. And then it says, when he finished speaking, he turned and attacked the enemy. This is the ancient general. Today, generals sit in the back, right, from a distance and push buttons and stuff. But in the ancient world, the king or the general of the army was on the front line. He was the great warrior leading the battle. So Judas is the great warrior here. Now, with the enemy behind him coming on the horizon and his army in front of him, he's trying to encourage them. When he's done giving them his encouraging words, he then draws his sword, turns, and attacks the enemy. Now, it just tells us that he crushed the enemy. I'm assuming the rest of his army followed him in the battle. But I love how the author describes that Judas doesn't care who's going to follow him in a battle. Judas is going to draw his sword, turn, and run at the enemy. That great courage and faith of Judas is what gives his army then the courage to follow him in the battle. 1 Maccabees chapter 3, verse 23. When he finished speaking, he rushed suddenly against Seron and his army, and they were crushed before him. They pursued them down the descent of Beth Horon to the plain. 800 of them fell, and the rest fled to the land of the Philistines. Then Judas and his brothers began to be feared, and terror fell upon the Gentiles round about them. His fame reached the king, and the Gentiles talked of the battles of Judas. He becomes famous, even among the Gentiles. When King Antiochus heard these reports, he was greatly angered. And he sent and gathered all the forces of his kingdom, a very strong army. And he opened his coffers and gave a year's pay to the forces and ordered them to be ready for any need. Then he saw that the money in the treasury was exhausted and the revenues from the country were small because of the dissension and disaster which he had caused in the land by abolishing the laws that had existed in the early days. He did not have such funds as he had before for his expenses and for the gifts which he had used to give more lavishly than preceding kings. He was greatly perplexed in mind and determined to go to Persia and collect the revenues from those regions and raise a large fund. He left Lysias, a distinguished man of royal lineage, in charge of the king's affairs from the river Euphrates to the borders of Egypt. So he's in charge of the Euphrates to Egypt, so the Holy Land. And he turned over to Lysias half of the troops and the elephants and gave him orders about all that he wanted done. And for the rest of Judea and Jerusalem, Lysias was to send a force against them to wipe out any and destroy the strength in Israel and the remnant of Jerusalem. He was to banish the memory of them from the place, settle aliens in all their territory, and distribute their land. Then the king took the remaining half of his troops and departed from Antioch, his capital, in the 147th year. He crossed the Euphrates River and went through the upper provinces. Lysias chose Ptolemy, the son of Dorymenes, this is not Ptolemy from Egypt, and Nicanor and Gorgias, mighty men among the friends of the king. He sent with them 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry to go into the land of Judah and destroy it, as the king had commanded. So they departed with their entire force, and when they arrived, they encamped at Emmaus in the plain. When the traders of the region heard what was said of them, they took silver and gold in immense amounts and fetters, and went to the camp to get the sons of Israel for slaves, and forces from Syria and the land of the Philistines joined with them. So even more that we can't even count them. Now, Judas and his brothers saw that the misfortunes had increased and the forces were encamped in their territory. They also learned what the king had commanded to do to the people to cause their final destruction. But they said to one another, "Let us repair the destruction of our people and fight for our people and our sanctuary." And the congregation assembled to be ready for battle and pray and ask for mercy and compassion. Jerusalem was uninhabited like a wilderness. Not one of her children went in or out. The sanctuary was trampled down. The sons of aliens held the citadel. It was a lodging place for the Gentiles. Joy was taken from Jacob. The flute and the harp ceased to play. Verse 46. So they assembled and went to Mizpah, opposite Jerusalem, because Israel formerly had a place of prayer in Mizpah. They fasted that day, put on sackcloth, sprinkled ashes on their heads, and rent their clothes. And they opened the books of the Torah to inquire into those matters about which the Gentiles were consulting the images of their idols. So while the Gentiles are relying upon their, obviously their pagan religions and their armies and their swords, and Judas and his men pray and fast. They also brought the garments of the priesthood and the first fruits of their tithes, and they stirred up the Nazarites who had completed their days, and they cried aloud to heaven, as to God, saying, "What shall we do with these? Where shall we take them? Thy sanctuary trampled down and profaned, thy priests mourned in humiliation, and behold, the Gentiles are assembled against us to destroy us, and they know what their plot against, thou knowest what they plot against us. How will we be able to withstand them if thou dost not help us?" Then they sounded the trumpet and gave a loud shout. And after this, Judas appointed leaders of the people in charge of the thousands, hundreds, and fifties, and tens. And he sent to them those who were building houses and were betrothed or were planting vineyards or were faint-hearted, and each should return to his home according to the Torah. Then the army marched out and encamped to the south of Emmaus. Judas said, "Gird yourselves and be valiant. Be ready early in the morning to fight with these Gentiles who have assembled against us to destroy us and our sanctuary. It is better for us to die in battle than to see the misfortunes of our nation and of the sanctuary. But as his will in heaven, God, may be, so he will do." Now, Gorgias took 5,000 infantry and 1,000 picked cavalry. Look at these numbers. So we already heard about, look at the numbers here are already, this was back in chapter 3, verse 39. 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry, plus a mixed multitude, they can't count them, the Philistines, the rest. Okay. And now it says Gorgias took 5,000 infantry and 1,000 picked cavalry, and his division moved out by night to fall upon the camp of the Jews and attack them suddenly. So they're going to try and rout them, right? Flank them. And men from the citadel were his guides. But Judas heard of it, and he and his mighty men moved out to attack the king's force in Emmaus, while the division was still absent from the camp. When Gorgias entered the camp of Judas by night, he found no one there. So he looked for them in the hills because he said, these men are fleeing from us. At daybreak, Judas appeared in the plain with 3,000 men. But they did not have armor. So 3,000 men, you remember the numbers here? Okay, we got 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry. Judas has 3,000 guys. 3,000 men, but they did not have armor and swords such as they desired. And they saw the camp of the Gentiles, strong and fortified, with cavalry round about. And these men were trained in war. These were professional soldiers. But Judas said to the men who were with him, do not fear their numbers or be afraid when they charge. Remember how our fathers were saved at the Red Sea when Pharaoh with his forces pursued them. And now let us cry to God, to heaven, to see whether he will favor us and remember his covenant with our fathers and crush this army before us today. Then all the Gentiles will know that there is one who redeems and saves Israel. Okay, so notice there, just like his father had done. When his father was trying to encourage his sons to have great faith, what does his father do? He reminds them of the stories of salvation history where God gave great victory to his people when they were under attack. What does Mattathias do? Well, he draws from that information, right? Judas has been catechized by his father. Judas knows the stories of salvation history. And so when Judas is facing great odds like this, he recalls situations that were similar in salvation history. And from that story, he derives great faith that these things could happen again. But what if he didn't know the story of Pharaoh and the cross of the Red Sea? What if Mattathias' father had not told his sons about those stories? What if Mattathias had not been told those stories? Well, we wouldn't be reading these stories today, because Mattathias would not have gone out to battle. Judas would not have gone out to battle. They would not have been victorious. They would not have had the courage, because they would not have had the faith, because they would not have had the reason for that great faith. We must know what God has done in order to have great faith in the present situation. So giving his soldiers 3,000 guys, impossible odds, right? 3,000 men against 40,000 cavalry, 40,000 foot soldiers, plus 7,000 cavalry. Impossible. This is absolutely impossible odds. And these guys are ill-equipped. They don't even have enough swords and armor as they would hope they could have. Verse 12, when the foreigners, and this is my second most favorite line in the whole book. So when he's done giving that speech, verse 12, when the foreigners looked up and saw them coming against them. Look at that. Right? Can you imagine? They're, you know, the Gentile camp is not expecting for Judas to attack. The Gentile camp is on the offensive. They've rolled into the region with all the tanks and F-16s. They've got a massive army of somewhere around 50,000 soldiers or something. Judas only has 3,000. So the Gentiles are on the offensive. They're going to decide when to attack. So they're waking up in the morning. They're making their coffee, scrambling some eggs over the campfire, getting ready And all of a sudden, someone sounds an alarm that Judas is attacking. He's attacking us. We're supposed to have him. He's going to attack us. And they look across the plain, and there's Judas with his 3,000 men running at them. Who do these people think they are? The army of the Gentiles. These are professional soldiers with swords, armor, chariots, horses, everything they could need. And there's 50,000 of them. When the foreigners looked up and saw them coming. I love that line. When the foreigners looked up and saw them coming against them, they went forth from their camp to battle. Then the men with Judas blew their trumpets and engaged in battle. The Gentiles were crushed and fled into the plain, and those in the rear fell by the sword. They pursued them from Gazara and to the plains of Idumea and to Azotus and Yamnia, and 3,000 of them fell. Then Judas and his force turned back from pursuing them. And he said to the people, "Do not be greedy for plunder, for there is a battle before us." So they routed this massive army. And then he says, guys, forget the gold, forget the swords, and like all that. Wait, we're not done with the battle. We have another battle before us. Gorgias and his force are near us in the hills. Stand now against our enemies and fight them. Afterwards, you can seize and plunder. Okay? Just as Judas was finished this speech, a detachment appeared coming out of the hills. They saw that their army had been put to flight and that the Jews were burning the camp. For the smoke that was seen showed what had happened. When they perceived this, they were greatly frightened. Right? They're only 5,000 of these guys. Okay, if Judas did this to with his 3,000 guys against that entire camp, Gorgias only has 5,000 guys with him. So they look down from the hills and they see what Judas did with his 3,000 guys. And these guys, there's no way we're going to fight against them. So it says, when they perceived this, were greatly frightened. And when they had saw the army of Judas drawn up in the plain for battle. So as soon as Judas and his men spot the army coming out of the hills, they assemble for battle. Can you imagine the trembling in the legs of these Gentile warriors as they look at these fearless men who with just 3,000 men took out the entire camp? And these guys up in the hills, only 5,000. Then Judas, as soon as they saw Judas and the army drawn up for battle, they all fled into the land of the Philistines. Then Judas returned to plunder the camp. Then they seized much gold and silver and cloth, dyed blue, sea purple, and great riches. On their return, they sang hymns and praises to God, to heaven. For he is good, for his mercy endures forever. Many of the Psalms have that verse in them. So, let's see here. We have verse 25. Thus Israel had a great deliverance that day. Those of the foreigners who encamped went and reported to Lysias all that had happened. When he heard it, he was perplexed and discouraged. For things had not happened to Israel as he had intended, nor had they returned out as the king had commanded. But the next year he mustered, look at these numbers, 60,000 picked infantry and 5,000 cavalry to subdue them. They came into Idumea and camped at Bethzur, and Judas met them with 10,000 men. When he saw the army was strong, he prayed, saying, look at this. Blessed art thou, O Savior of Israel, who didst crush the attack of the mighty warrior by the hand of thy servant David. and it's give the camp, the Philistines, into the hand of Jonathan, the son of Saul, and the man who carried his armor, right? You remember those stories? So David conquered Goliath and impossible odds. And then you remember Jonathan and his armor bearer crept into a garrison of the Philistines and took them all out. So do thou him in this army by the hand of thy people Israel, and let them be ashamed of their troops and their cavalry. Fill them with cowardice, melt the boldness of their strength. Let them tremble in their destruction. Strike them down with the sword of those who love thee, and let all who know thy name praise thee with hymns. Then both sides attacked, and there fell the army of Lysias, 5,000 men. They fell in action, and when Lysias saw the rout of his troops and observed the boldness which inspired those of Judas, and how ready they were either to live or to die nobly, he departed to Antioch and enlisted mercenaries to invade Judea with even a larger army. Then Judas and his brothers said to his brothers, behold, our enemies are crushed. Let us go up to cleanse our sanctuary and dedicate it. So all the army assembled, and they went up to Mount Zion. And they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned, the gates burned. The courts, they saw bushes sprung up in a thicket or at one of the mountains. They saw also the chambers of the priests in ruins. Then they rent their clothes, mourned with great lamentation, sprinkled themselves with ashes. They fell face down on the ground. They sounded the signal on the trumpets and cried out to heaven, to God. Then Judas detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he had cleansed the sanctuary. He chose blameless priests devoted to the Torah, and they cleansed the sanctuary, removed the defiled stones to an unclean place, they deliberated what to do. So here this is the story of the cleansing of the temple. So remember, Jerusalem, as we heard in chapter 1, had been turned into a Gentile citadel. So after all this great victory, Judas knows there's no way that they're going to be able to resist him in Jerusalem. So he goes, he takes out the Gentiles, but he just starts the battle. He pushes them out of the temple. He goes in with the temple with other priests. Remember, Judas is a priest. He goes in there with other priests, the line of Aaron, and they begin to sweep and pull out the Windex and start polishing the silk. And he tells his men, clean the rest of the city out. So he commands his soldiers to continue fighting the battle to push the Gentiles out of the city. But while they're doing that, he has Windex and a broom and is starting to clean up the temple. Notice he has his priorities straight. When they're done cleansing the temple, they rededicate it. Recorded verse 52. Early in the morning, on the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, in the 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifice as the law directs on the new altar of burnt offering, which they had built. At the very season and on the very day, the Gentiles had profaned it. It was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshiped and blessed God, bless heaven, it says here, bless God, who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication. The word dedication in Hebrew is Hanukkah. This is the feast of Hanukkah that eventually the Jews celebrate. On the altar for 8 days and offered burnt offerings. Verse 59, then Judas and his brothers and all the assemblies of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of dedication of the altar, Hanukkah, of the altar should be observed with gladness and joy. And of course, even until today, the Jews have continued to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the feast, is mentioned even in John's gospel. It says Jesus went to Jerusalem during the feast of the dedication. That's the feast of Hanukkah. John chapter 10, verse 22. And that is the story of the Maccabean revolt. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and to age of ages. Amen.